Hello, everybody. Welcome. I'm glad you were able to make it out here in this kind of stormy night. I guess it's somewhat appropriate that one of the topics in the title has to do with weather. To get started, I like quotations. And I wanted to read you a couple of quotations. One of them is by Lauren Isley, and he writes, "If there is magic on this planet, it is contained in water." Another one by Luna Leopold. "Water is the most critical resource issue of our lifetime and our children's lifetime. The health of our waters is the principal measure of how we live on the land." Now, you'd think with quotes like that, and in this day and age, that people and our population would have a much better awareness and appreciation of our environment, especially considering the fact that land provides our food, water, our drink, and the air, the oxygen which we breathe. But some studies have been conducted that says that our population in the United States and on this planet is really not that environmentally literate. One study found that 80% of the population is influenced by faulty understanding of the environment, that there's a belief in myths, environmental myths. For example, 45 million Americans believe that the ocean is a source of fresh water. 60% of Americans do not know what a watershed is. 50% of the population of the United States thinks astrology is scientific. And I give those quotes as a basis for why we put together the Texas Water Symposium, is that one of the things that we've recognized is that water is going to be one of our critical limiting resources as our population continues to grow and grow. It's a limited resource, and we need to understand. And typically, the way most Americans get their information is by the media. And the media doesn't have much time except to give a single, small, superficial explanation about whatever the water topic is. Water is extremely complex. And so what the purpose of the Water Symposium is to provide a forum in which we have some of the states and national leading experts about water explain some of the complexity. Some of the past Water Symposium issues we've had have dealt with water policy. We've had river authorities here. We've talked about water conservation, the science of water. And tonight's topic, I believe, is going to be one of the most pressing issues that the world will be facing when it comes to water, and that has to do with climate change. So, to increase our understanding of climate change and how it may affect water and future generations, we put together a panel, and our first speaker tonight is not with us physically. She's here in spirit because I got a call at 10 o'clock this morning, and Catherine told me that Lubbock, Texas is in a whiteout. But we have arranged for her to be here spiritually via technical means. So let me talk about Catherine Hayhoe a little bit, one of our panelists. She's a respected authority on climate change. From 2008 to 2009, she served as lead author on the federal report Global Climate Change Impacts in the United States. She has led climate impact assessments for cities and regions from Chicago to California, and her findings have been presented before Congress, highlighted in briefings to state and federal agencies, and featured in news and media outlets around the world. She is listed as the American Association of University Women list of the top 100 Texas women of distinction in 2008. So, Catherine Hayhoe, Texas Tech University.
Thank you, Tom, and thank you, everybody. I hope you can hear me all right. I see a few nods. Good. I am very happy to be here, like Tom said, spiritually, if not physically. As he said, here in Lubbock, we've got some really bad weather going on. But it's wonderful to see your faces and to be able to talk to you about water and climate and how those interact together. Here in Texas, water is one of our most valuable resources. We depend on it for our agriculture, for our homes, for business and industry. Here in Texas, it's home to 4 out of the 10 fastest growing cities in the entire nation. In West Texas alone, we produce about a third of the nation's cotton. All of these activities depend on water. And this dependence that we have on water makes us vulnerable. In the western half of the state, most of our water comes from reservoirs, like the Ogallala, that lies deep underground. Ever since irrigation began in the 1950s, the level of this aquifer has dropped steadily, in some places more than 150 feet over the past 50 years. Other places depend on surface water, which doesn't always come when you want it to. We've had bad droughts before, in the 1930s, of course, and then more recently in the 1950s, and even just in the past decade, we've experienced droughts that have cost more than hundreds of millions of dollars in lost agriculture revenues. But when we look at past records, we see that the droughts of the 1950s and even the 1930s are nothing compared to the droughts that this region has experienced historically. If you look at past records, going back hundreds and even a couple of thousand years, you can see that in this region, they experienced regular mega droughts that lasted decades. So we know that natural variability, as we can see in these long-term climate records, tell us to be cautious, to conserve our resources. It tells us that this last century, the 1900s, was actually unusually wet in this part of the country. But today is another reason to be cautious and conservative with the resources as well. The climate, which is the average conditions of our planet over decades, is currently experiencing a degree of change that's unprecedented in the history of human civilization. Thermometer records going back hundreds of years tell us two things. First of all, they tell us that temperatures go up and down from year to year. This happens in the places where we live, and it happens over the whole planet. We might have a very cold year this year, or we might have a very warm year the next. That's what we call weather. But our thermometer records also tell us something else, and that is that temperatures at the global scale have been steadily increasing. Not only that, but they've actually been increasing faster and faster. If you look at the last 150 years, the last 100, the last 50, and the last 25, each one of those time periods is experiencing more and more rapid increase in global temperature, despite the fact that we still get cold weather today. Tom mentioned that there's many myths that we believe about science. And one of the main myths that you can see just about any time you turn on the TV, I just saw it myself the other day, is that climate and weather are the same things. But in fact, they're completely different. Weather is what we intuitively understand. Weather is this blizzard that we've got in Lubbock. Well, you've got pouring rain down there in Junction. Weather is the fact that we can have an El Nino one year, which means a really wet winter for us here in West Texas. And then you can have a La Nina the next winter, which means almost no rain at all. That's weather. But when we talk about climate, we're talking about the average conditions over decades. As Mark Twain said, climate is what you expect and weather is what you get. So we can look at our records from the sun and we can say, are we getting more energy from the sun? And when we do that, we see that actually over the last 40 years, we have been getting less energy from the sun. So if our climate were currently being controlled by the sun, it would actually be getting cooler right now, not warmer. Then we can say, well, what about natural cycles? We've seen some pretty big natural cycles in the past. Couldn't this climate change be because of just another natural cycle? So we can look at these natural cycles like El Nino, for example, or the cycles that used to put us into ice ages a long time ago. And when we look at these cycles, we see that the conditions we're experiencing today look nothing like the past natural cycles. In fact, many of our conditions are far outside the range of natural cycles in the past. So that can't explain it either. Instead, the only explanation we can find for our current change is the fact that ever since the Industrial Revolution, we've been burning increasing amounts of coal and gas and oil. Every time we burn these fuels, they release heat-trapping gases into the atmosphere. These gases, like I said, trap heat. You can measure their properties in any lab. I did it myself as an undergraduate. And as we build up the levels of these gases in the atmosphere, it's essentially like wrapping an extra blanket around the Earth. We already have an atmosphere that's perfectly suited for life. It keeps us at exactly the right temperature for our planet. But what's happening is, just like my grandmother used to do, when I used to stay at her house when I was a little girl, she would sneak in after I went to sleep, and she was afraid that I would be cold, so she would put an extra blanket over me. And I would wake up about an hour later sweating because I didn't need that extra blanket. It was trapping too much of my body heat under the covers. And that is exactly what we are doing to our planet. We are producing these heat-trapping gases. You can measure them coming out of the tailpipe of any car or out of the smokestack of any factory. And it is exactly as if we're wrapping an extra blanket around the Earth. And that extra blanket is trapping more of the Earth's heat inside the atmosphere that would otherwise escape to space. And so we're warming the temperature of the Earth. Temperature isn't our only indicator of change. It's not just about what thermometers are telling us. If we look around the world, we see all kinds of signs that are telling us that something is different. Here in Lubbock, we are seeing birds here that you didn't used to see until you were halfway down to Corpus Christi, you know, past Junction. We've got fire ants spreading through Lubbock, and we're not the only ones seeing changes. Kudzu, that green vine that took over the south, has spread so far north that it's actually already into Canada. And kudzu is controlled by warm winters. By cold winters. In Canada, they're not getting the cold winters they used to, and so kudzu has made it all the way up from North Carolina to Canada. If you look around the planet, we see melting ice, we see changing bird migration pathways and timing, we see the fact that spring is coming over a week earlier across the Northern Hemisphere. All in all, we see more than 25,000 physical indicators that our planet is changing. 25,000 different independent lines of evidence that something different is happening to our world. There's a lot of other questions that we have related to climate change, and it's hard to answer them all here. So I just want to let you know about a really good resource, a book that I wrote just a couple months ago called A Climate for Change, Global Warming Facts for Faith-Based Decisions. You can get it in any Barnes & Noble or online on Amazon. And in that book, I talk about a lot of the information that I'm talking about here, but I also get more into depth on a lot of other questions you might have heard. Like, I've heard people talk about global cooling. What's up with that? Or aren't those scientists always disagreeing and arguing with each other and using tricks with their data? And then also, just the simple fact of it's so cold outside, it's snowing outside, where's global warming now? So it's hard to get into all of these questions with just a few minutes here, but if you're really interested in this topic, I'd encourage you to pick up a copy of this book, A Climate for Change, or you can even Google it and read it online. And it answers a lot of our common questions about climate change. So if it's true that humans are the main influence on what's happening to our planet right now, what does this mean for our future? Well, first of all, a warmer world will need more water. It's a simple fact that the hotter it is outside, the faster water evaporates. So even, for example, if our rainfall doesn't change at all here in Texas, we're still going to need about 30 or 40% more water for our crops, just because that water will evaporate so much faster as it gets hotter and hotter. We're not as bad off as some other places that depend on melting snow or melting ice for their water supply. In California, half of their water supply comes from melting snow in the Sierra Nevada mountains. That snow is now melting earlier and earlier in the year, and more of it is falling as rain, which washes away in the winter when you don't need it, and less of it is falling as snow, which conveniently stays on the ground till about April or May, and then it melts and runs into the rivers just when you need it for your crops. So California is already experiencing major water shortages just because they don't have enough to go around. And in the future, they stand to lose up to half of their water supply that used to come from the snow in the mountains. Even California isn't as bad off as cities like Lima, Peru. In Lima, you think it's dry in West Texas, Lima gets less than 2 inches of rain per year. They've got about 8 million people that depend on glacier melt for their water. That glacier melt runs through irrigation channels, some of which were actually built by the Incas hundreds of years ago. And for the first time in the history of civilization in Peru, those irrigation channels are starting to run dry. The main glacier that supplies Lima with most of its water is thought to be completely melted as soon as a decade from now. So in Lima, they are building desalinization plants because that's the only way that they're going to get their water. They really are going to get fresh water from the ocean. It's not going to be a myth anymore because that's the only choice they have. Here in Texas, we're also at the limit of our resources. Like I said, we've got 4 of the top 10 fastest growing urban centers. We've got major agriculture going across all of Texas. All of these need water. And we need even more water than we've got right now. Climate change is occurring on top of stresses that already exist. If we had more water than we know what to do with, climate change might not seriously affect our water supply. But the fact of the matter is, water is already a precious and a valuable resource. And climate change runs the risk of being straw that breaks the camel's back. What climate change does is it tells us that we need to make wise decisions about our water. First of all, we need to prepare for the changes that we can't avoid. Second of all, we need to build resilience into our systems so that we are not relying on sources that could run dry temporarily during a drought or permanently as a result of a long-term shift in climate. And last of all, we need to reduce the effect that we're having on our planet. We can do that by shifting from our old and dirty ways of getting energy. These ways need water. If you generate energy from coal-fired or gas-fired plants, you need water to do that. Also, these ways rely on energy, much of the energy that comes from outside the country. Instead, we need to shift to clean, homegrown sources of energy, like the wet wind turbines that are covering the high plains of Texas. Ways of energy that will not run out on us and that don't use more of our valuable water. We need to do this because it just makes sense. Water is essential to life. It's our most valuable resource that we have, and it makes all the sense in the world to do everything we can to preserve and conserve and protect it for ourselves and for future generations. Thank you.
Thank you, Catherine. If you can stick around after our two presentations, then Catherine will be able to answer questions, I believe. Our next speaker is Todd Butler. Todd served as the federal special master for the U.S. District Court in Midland in the Sierra Club versus San Antonio Endangered Species Act litigation over the Edwards Aquifer. He also was assistant to the federal court monitor during the Sierra Club versus Babbitt, which established the first limits on pumping from the Edwards Aquifer. A Texas native, Butler has his PhD in environmental geography from Texas State University and is a frequent contributor to popular publications on the Edwards Aquifer and other Texas water issue. He is also editor-in-chief of the Texas Water Journal, and he works for the Guadalupe Blanco River Authority as executive manager of intergovernmental relations and policy. Todd Butler.
Thanks for that introduction, Tom. And let me just say it's a pleasure to be here with you tonight and also with Dr. Hayo and Dr. Mace on this panel. Now, Dr. Hayo is a hard act to follow. She did a great job. And so I'm not really going to be talking about climate impacts or climate change impacts. I'm going to be looking back a little into history. Now, I want to have a quote, too. I want to start off with a quote because we've had some good quotes to start off here. It's another Mark Twain quote, and it's one of my favorite. Water taken in moderation never hurt anyone. So, and if you work as a water resource manager, that has a double meaning. But let me just say that water resource managers are working with climate change projections, and they are trying to figure out what to do with them. Now, let me just start off by saying that water resource managers work with lots of models, and most of the models that we work with are much simpler than a global climate change model. Work with models such as the water availability model that helps us determine how much water is left in a river for permitting, models that are designed to help indicate what the yield might be for a new water project, models that indicate potential ecological impacts to rivers and estuaries based on a range of conditions. You know, these models are much less sophisticated than a global climate change model. And even these simple models are the subject of substantial disagreement because of the range of uncertainties associated with them and the assumptions used to create them. Many of us spend a lot of time in meetings talking about model results and whether we use the right model or we have the right data, whether the right assumptions were used in the model. And I don't want you to think that I don't believe models are useful. In fact, they're critical to water management and planning, and we depend on them. However, I think some of the uncertainties associated with much simpler models than a global climate change model has resulted and some resistance or maybe skepticism among water resource managers about more complex models like global climate change models. And that's something I see in the water resource management community, which is really dominated by engineers, not by modelers. So, you know, having said that, is there another way to get people thinking about potential extremes in future climate within the community of individuals who determine how much water we need in the future and manage the water we have now? Well, I believe that there is, and Catherine did hit on this briefly. The past can be a key to the future to a certain extent. And the organization I work for, the Guadalupe Blanco River Authority, has been focusing its efforts recently on preparing for future extremes in climate by attempting to uncover more information about the past range of historical conditions that have occurred in South Central Texas. Now, let me give you a little example. About 50 years ago, or over the last 50 years, we've seen some pretty amazing variation in water resource conditions. And I'll just talk about the Guadalupe River here for a moment. We have some few days during the drought of record, the drought in the 1940s and 50s, where there was essentially no flow in the Guadalupe River when you got down near the end of it. The two major springs, which provide a majority or at least a substantial amount of the flow in the river during droughts, Comal Springs and San Marcos Springs, which issue from the Edwards. Comal Springs dried up during a portion of 1956. San Marcos Springs was substantially curtailed, but was still flowing somewhat. And so very little water was making it all the way down to the end of the river. Now, compare that to the flood of 1998, where the estimate is we have 466,000 cubic feet per second of flow from the Guadalupe River into San Antonio Bay. Now, that's close to the flow of the Mississippi River near New Orleans. And so you have that variation, those extremes, almost no flow during severe long-term drought, and then just, you know, really kind of unbelievable amount of flow during one of the most significant floods. And with a little theme music there, talking a little bit more about the 98 flood, it was produced in part by 20 inches of rain over a very large area in south central Texas within a 24-hour period. In fact, near San Marcos, there was 36 inches of rain within 24 hours, and Dr. Arsufi found himself swept up in the flood in a university vehicle, I think, and so he knows about that flood firsthand. Those kind of variations really provide a challenge for water resource managers. Now, we have instrumental records in this region of rainfall. That's just rainfall measurements going back about 115 years. But 115 years is really a snapshot in terms of, you know, the amount of time you need to really understand the drought cycle in a region. And so since it's droughts that are really the basis for what we do in water management, and the drought of record, which is the state drought that started in 47 in some places, 50 in other places, ended in 1957, affected 94% of the state. 254 counties were declared disaster areas by the time it ended in 57. That's what we use as the basis for what we do. How are the various options and water projects and water plans we develop, how are they going to survive another drought like that? So I'd like to tell you how we are trying to learn more about the drought of record and other droughts which have occurred in the past, which, as Dr. Hayhoe mentioned, were substantially more severe and lasted longer. Currently, the Guadalupe Blanco River Authority, the University of Arkansas, and the University of Texas are conducting a tree ring study using bald cypress trees. Now, we're trying to take cores from living bald cypress trees. These trees can live well over 500 years, and use those cores to try to reconstruct the drought cycle over the last 400 years or more, if we're lucky. Now, it turns out that bald cypress trees, like all trees for the most part, put down an annual layer of wood on the outside just below the bark, and that's what we call a growth ring. And if you have a dry year, that growth ring tends to be narrow because there's not much water and the tree doesn't grow much. If you have normal or wet conditions, that growth ring might be fairly thick. And so by taking a increment bore, which looks kind of like a drill, and drilling it into the tree and extracting a sample from the tree, which, of course, doesn't hurt the tree, you can look at the width of those rings and tell something about the drought cycle. And so we've been collecting samples from the San Bernard River in the east over to the Frio in the west, down on the coast near the Guadalupe Delta, or actually in the Guadalupe Delta, up to the area around Lake Travis, in an attempt to get a really good picture in a large area of Texas about what these past droughts have looked like. And we are analyzing some of the samples we have now, and they're going to yield some pretty interesting results, I think. But we're still collecting samples. And I'm hoping that this study is going to be completed in June. If you want to find out more about it, you can go to YouTube and put in the words climate detective, and a little 5-minute video on the study will come up that was produced by Texas Parks and Wildlife. So the tree ring study I'm talking about is going to hopefully help us put the drought of record in the proper context. More than likely, there are droughts that have occurred, and I can tell you they almost, that's a certainty, in the past, last few hundred years, that were longer than 7 to 10 years and were more severe than the drought in the 1950s. Now, we appear, you know, obviously look outside and it's raining. I'm not sure if you're really out of the drought here in Junction yet. Other parts of the drought-affected area the last couple of years are coming out of the drought, certainly. But not everything is recovered yet. I mean, we have reservoirs which still are below their normal levels and substantially below their capacities. But if you just look at the 2008-2009 drought and the 2005-2006 drought, also a short drought that was pretty severe, and even the 94-96 drought, I think most people remember that drought, I think it's pretty clear that the state is not fully prepared for another drought like the drought of record. And I think it's important for us to focus on at least being prepared for a drought like that in hopes of being able to be prepared for substantial increases in the variation of our climate going forward. I mean, we really need to be able to weather a 7 to 10 year drought, because so far the studies show that we get one every, you know, 50 to 100 years. We'll know, I think, much more about how often those types of droughts occur once our study is completed. But certainly, you know, that is a standard which we use, which is a good one, and which I think we're really not prepared for right now. So those conclude my remarks. And I actually left a little time for you, Dr. Mace.
Thank you, Todd. Our next presenter is Robert E. Mace, who has worked with the Texas groundwater issues for more than 15 years. He is Deputy Executive Administrator at the Texas Water Development Board and manages the Water Science and Conservation Program area for the agency. Robert has a B.S. in geophysics and an M.S. in hydrology from New Mexico Institute of Mining and Technology, as well as a Ph.D. in hydrogeology from UT Austin. He worked 8 years as a staff hydrogeologist at the Bureau of Economic Geology before joining the Texas Water Development Board in the summer of 1999. Robert?
Thank you, Tom. You've heard a couple water quotes, so I'm going to go ahead and start with a water Texism. There's an old Texas saying, if you don't like the weather, just wait a few minutes. We've certainly seen some of that today. I'm going to modify a little bit of that quote or that Texism for today's topic, which is, if you don't like the climate, just wait a few decades. And that applies not only to past climate, as you've heard from Dr. Votler and Dr. Hayhoe. We've seen worse droughts than Texas has experienced in the record. And even setting aside human-forced climate change, we're going to see very likely droughts in the future and changes in our climate. On top of that, with human-forced climate change, we might be seeing more of that. What I'm going to spend my time chatting with y'all this evening about is just climate change in Texas, some numbers that I've pulled out of the International Panel on Climate Change report, as well as some work done by folks at University of Texas. Talk a little bit about climate change and water, and then some thoughts on how climate change might affect water in Texas specifically. Now, the International Panel on Climate Change, which I'm going to go ahead and shorten to IPCC, is that group, that international group of scientists that comes out with a report, kind of the state of the science, about every 5 years. And the last report that came out, which came out in 2002, I believe, or 2007, I'm sorry, showed, looking at 21 climate models, showed for the North American continent increases in temperature. All the models project an increase in temperature. Those climate models also make projections on precipitation. And for Texas, and it actually varies for the North American continent, there's predictions that it's going to be wetter, more on the northern part of the continent, North American continent, and drier on the southern part. Looking at Texas, most of the models project it's going to be overall drier in Texas, but not all the models. About a third of those models suggest it's going to be wetter in Texas. And here comes that uncertainty in what the models are projecting. Now, the global climate models, the ones that are modeling the entire planet, and if you pull out your magnifying glass in that report and look at Texas, which is kind of a little more than a speck on those maps, they're projecting a 4.5 to 6 degree Fahrenheit increase in temperature over the next 100 years. They also suggest that the runoff, when it rains and the water runs off the land and goes into a stream or a river, for Texas, the global analyses project there may be a decrease of 0 to 10% of that runoff. And there's also a suggestion that flow seasonality in those rivers may increase, with more rainfall during the wet season and less rainfall during the dry season, so greater variability. And we in Texas already know what variability is about, so perhaps there might be greater variability. Charles Jackson at the University of Texas has looked at what are called statistically downscaled models. So these global climate models are using statistics kind of brought down more to a Texas level. So we can look in more detail what those models are suggesting might happen for Texas in the future. And just as all the models, of course, show that things are going to get warmer in Texas, the climate's going to get warmer in Texas, it's true also for Texas. And his analysis showed that by 2050, Texas in general is going to be, the climate in general is going to be about 3 degrees Fahrenheit warmer. When you average all the projections of these climate models on precipitation, it's a more varied picture. All averaged together, it suggests that the Gulf Coast region is actually going to be slightly wetter, 0.3 additional inches. The rest of the state, and especially in the High Plains area where Dr. Hayhoe is at, suggests there's going to be an overall deficit of about 0.6 inches. Again, these are multiple models all averaged together. Some of the models show increases in rainfall, some of the models show decreases in rainfall. And those numbers I just quoted you don't seem a whole lot. 0.3 inches more, probably not a big deal. Half an inch less, I'm sure folks out in the High Plains would probably want that half inch back. But the models show great variations with respect to precipitation. For example, one of the models shows all of Texas having increases in rainfall. 2 inches up in the High Plains, more than 4 inches for East Texas. Some models show a split, kind of right down I-35, where it's wetter in the wetter part of the state, East Texas, and it's drier in the drier part of the state. So there's a great deal of uncertainty in terms of what climate change or what the future holds in terms of precipitation or rainfall. Now, when you think about climate change and water, it's kind of obvious. If climate change is going to affect rainfall, there's going to be more rainfall, maybe there's going to be less rainfall, that's going to have a direct impact on your water resources. How much water are you going to have running off the land into your stream, into your reservoirs? Or how much water are you going to have infiltrating into the ground for plants to take up, or water that continues down to the water table? Taking this climate change information and getting it down to where water managers can use it gets a little difficult because of these uncertainties in modeling that you've already heard Dr. Vautler talk about. A couple of quotes from the IPCC report. One says, quantitative projections of changes in precipitation, river flows, and water levels at the river basin scale remain uncertain. And another quote is that climate projections from global climate models are not easy to incorporate into hydrological studies because of significant uncertainties in the modeling process. So there's still a great deal of uncertainty. And, you know, what do we do as folks that, you know, are looking for the state's water future? How do we factor that into what we're doing? A recent book, and I believe this book is out, by Gerald North, that's summarizing kind of the state of the science of climate change for Texas, notes that the forecasting of future climate details for a region as small as Texas is still problematic. So that's our challenge as water planners and water managers, is what do we do with this information? Again, climate change, it's going to affect rainfall. It would have an effect on runoff, recharge to the aquifer. Dr. Hayhoe mentioned evaporation. Turns out that's a pretty big one. Evapotranspiration, the amount of water that a plant uptakes, that has an impact on our water resources. Use, how climate change might affect use. And then as well as drought. What does climate change mean for drought? Now, the IPCC report has a map that shows areas across the globe that they feel are susceptible to climate change. And it shows Southwest Texas and actually a great deal of Western United States as being one of those areas. I guess a combination of increasing population as well as concerns about what climate change means for water resources. We've already talked about the precipitation or how rainfall might be affected or might not be affected in Texas. It might go up, it might go down. In general, the model suggests drier conditions. Looking at runoff, the IPCC report suggests no effect on runoff to perhaps a 30% decrease in runoff. And of course, folks such as Todd, who works for the Guadalupe Blanco River Authority, are relying on some runoff in order to fill those reservoirs up. Also, I think a decrease in runoff suggests that there's, you know, more water being uptake by plants or by evaporation. That could mean there's less recharge occurring to the state's aquifers. Recharge, that water that trickles down from the land surface and makes it down to our aquifers, globally is expected to increase by 2%. But that's a global average. And just like politics, all recharge is local. It's going to depend on what's happening with your rainfall, with your temperature, with evapotranspiration. There's actually been some global studies on recharge that suggest West Texas recharge could increase or decrease by 30%. That's probably a safe projection, I would argue. Not terribly helpful, though, as far as water planning is concerned. I think, as it turns out, evaporation is real key. Even though we've got this uncertainty in how precipitation might express itself in the future in Texas due to human-forced climate change, you know, all the models, again, suggest it is going to get warmer. When it gets warmer, that increases evaporation. And that has effects. You know, obviously, if you've got a big reservoir, that's taking up a lot more water. It's getting evaporated. It also affects runoff, because if there's a lot more evaporation happening on your land, well, that leaves the soil drier, so when the next rain comes, it's keeping that water, not letting it run off. And also, it's taking that water and putting it back up in the atmosphere and perhaps not letting as much make it down to the aquifers. If you look at that, say a 3 Fahrenheit increase in temperature in the next 50 years, annual evaporation in Texas could be expected to increase from about 3 inches up in northeast Texas to over 10 inches down in the Big Bend area. And that's a pretty good amount of water, about 7.2 inches for here, I calculated for you. Also, evapotranspiration can be affected. From what I've read, there's an expectation that there'll be an overall decrease in evapotranspiration. Plants like CO2, and so that helps them process water more efficiently. However, just like politics, just like recharge, all evapotranspiration is local, and so it's going to depend on what's going on with the climate in any particular area where there are plants transpiring water. The Lower Colorado River Authority took a look at how climate change might affect its water resources. And they came up with some interesting results. They took a look at the global climate models and looked at 8 different scenarios. And they saw in all their scenarios an increase in temperature. Some of the scenarios projected decreased rainfall. Some of them projected increased rainfall. Now you might think, you're going to get some more rainfall. That means you're going to have higher lake levels. You get lower rainfall, you're going to have lower lake levels. As it turns out from their analysis, they had lower runoff on all those scenarios, even with increased rainfall. And that's because the increased temperature, increased evaporation, actually overall decreased flows. And in fact, to give you some numbers, they projected by 2050 that stream flow in the Colorado River near Lake Travis was projected to decrease from 17% to 38%. So even with an increased rainfall amount, a decrease of 17% of river flow. Kind of interesting. Dr. Hayhoe referred to use being affected by climate change. And certainly the obvious one is agriculture. She quoted a number of 30%. There was a study done by A&M in South Central Texas, the irrigation area over the Edwards Aquifer, suggested about a 31% increase in irrigation water use or irrigation demand. Municipal demand, not so much, maybe 1.5 to 3.5% increase, probably from increased water for watering the yard, and maybe folks need to take more showers when it gets a little warmer out. Now, interestingly, for aquifers, this increase in use has an effect. For example, if it gets a lot warmer and drier in the high plains of Texas, that's going to create more pumping, which that's going to have then an effect on the aquifer. I think that's true anywhere across the state, wherever there's more pumping coming out. Also, being a groundwater hydrologist, less surface water probably means that's going to get people to use more groundwater. So there perhaps in the future there'll be a push to using more groundwater. Dr. Hayhoe referred to how energy use involves water use. If there's more biofuels, along with that goes more pumping. And we've seen some of that even in the high plains of Texas, of more groundwater pumping trying to produce ethanol. And then, interestingly enough, I'm talking to a lady from France that was kind of exploring perhaps coming to Texas to build power plants, that lower CO2 emissions for power plants equals more water use, greater water use. So again, there's a lot of indirect paths for affecting water resources, perhaps trying to fix one problem, but perhaps creating another one. And then, the water is connected. So groundwater is connected to surface water, so more pumping of groundwater will probably decrease base flow or discharges from an aquifer to a surface water resource. Another thing that folks have written about is effects of climate change on drought, and that IPCC report suggests that the number of extreme drought events per 100 years are expected to increase 2 to 6 times by the 2090s. And so greater variability, perhaps more droughts. One thing I've often wondered, and maybe I'll ask Dr. Hayhoe this, she's gone, she's still here? Okay. The drought of the 50s was a pretty persistent drought. Depending where you're at, anywhere from 5 to 10 years. And so does increased variability in climate change actually break up a drought like the drought of the 50s? I don't know, which could be a good thing. And then, of course, as Dr. Votler's told you, tree rings suggest that there's been much more severe droughts in the past. And so what we saw in the 50s, which was a pretty devastating drought, even without human forced climate change, we could be seeing something far worse in the future anyways. In terms of what Texas is doing, we have our regional water planning process, and it's been recognized by folks concerned about climate change and water resources that requires an adaptive process. You can't make decisions now and expect decisions on water resources now and expect that those are going to serve you far into the future. And in Texas, we have regional water planning, which happens on a five-year or reoccurs on a five-year level. So it's very adaptive. It can respond to the latest in science, the latest in technology, and what's actually happening in terms of the climate in Texas. The other neat thing about planning in Texas is that we plan for the drought of record. Todd probably has a different opinion on what the drought of record is, but looking at the measured record, we plan for the drought of the 50s. And so we're planning for the worst thing that we've seen over the last 100, 125 years or so. Certainly the past shows that there are worse droughts, but at least we're not planning for average conditions, because we know the next drought is always around the corner in Texas. Unfortunately, as Dr. Votler pointed out, the state's not ready for the next drought of record, let alone a drought that we've seen in the tree rings in the past, or perhaps a drought that's coming in the future. And so there's still a lot that Texas needs to do in implementing the state water plan or the regional water plans to make sure that we're ready for the next drought. And anything that we do along those lines is just going to help us overall in Texas. One thing I thought that was interesting, close my comments out, was, what's happening now in Texas? And Texas has a great deal of variety in weather, as well as in climate. I remember I grew up in Illinois, and of course, we had seasonal variations in the climate. In Texas, it seems like you can get the seasons in one day, where it takes a whole year to get those in northern Illinois. And that variability makes it a little hard to tease out exactly what's happening in Texas. The state climatologist looks very closely at what the climate trends are. And he's got a chapter in that book I mentioned earlier, Gerald North's book, looking at the past climate in Texas. It's really hard to detect a trend there because there's so much variability. Some folks will talk about that there's been a warming in Texas, but they tend to just be looking at the last 20 to 30 years. If you look at the last 100 years or so, you really can't see a trend. The state climatologist notes that the climate in Texas, at least for the last 100 years, doesn't seem to be following the projections out of the global climate models. That doesn't mean that what the global climate models are saying about the globe are untrue. It just gets problematic as you bring that global climate model down to even an area as big as Texas. And so, again, this adaptive planning process, Texans can see how exactly climate change or how the climate's changing with time and then adjust as appropriate as we go forward. So with that, I'll sum up with, since I don't have another quote, the same quote, if you don't like the climate, just wait a few decades. Thank you.
Chance to thank our panel, and we can open it up for questions right now. I'll start off.
That's cheating.
This is Dr. Botler.
Tom was on my committee when I was getting my doctorate, so right. I'm used to having questions from him. Okay.
But you were talking about that historically we have much more extreme droughts in our past. And the drought of the 50s, that's the drought record that we use for water planning, is really minor relative to what we've seen historically. If that's the case, and you were talking about we need to do better planning for at least the drought of record, if not more severe droughts, why are river authorities selling their water?
Well, the river authorities were set up on the TVA model, Tennessee Valley Authority model. And so they don't receive any type of appropriation from the state. And the only way to fund their operations is through the sale of water, or water and wastewater, water treatment, fees or power generation. Some, like the Guadalupe Blanco River Authority, has some hydroelectric power generation. LCRA has a substantial, I mean, actually the vast majority of their revenue comes from power generation from coal-fired power plants, but that's somewhat, I mean, that's a unique case. So, you know, the river authorities are there to meet the demand of the communities that they serve. And so, you know, if San Marcos, for example, or Victoria or another city does not project that it's going to grow and doesn't need additional supplies of water in the future, then you know, the river, that's reflected in the regional water plan. But for our basin, which includes San Marcos and New Braunfels and Victoria, as I mentioned, and some of those areas, it's one of the fastest growing areas in the state, and has been until recently among the fastest growing in the country. So, you know, we are designed to provide water to the citizens of our basin, and you know, that's how we function.
This is a new nonprofit that educates on water scarcity issues. I'm out of San Antonio. And I had a question for Dr. Vodler. A member of my advisory board is Dr. David Staley of the University of Arkansas, a dendrochronologist.
Yes.
And it's my understanding that he's carrying forth a great deal of the research of Dr. Richard Seeger of the Lamont-Doherty Earth Observatory at Columbia. And it was pretty much, from what I understood, talking to Dr. Staley, that a lot of the work had been done on dendrochronology in Texas, and I was just wondering what you would say to that. Are you filling in work that has not previously been done, or is this much more extensive and definitely kind of proving a point? And I would add, and I just have to say, sure. My hydrologist, Raymond Slade, always asks us to remember that when we're talking about the drought of record, we're also talking about the per capita drought of record, which is a completely different issue in this day and time and in the future. But seriously, I would like to hear about how your research connects with Dr. Staley's. Thank you.
Well, Dr. Staley has been helping out with this study to a certain extent. His son, Danny Staley, is one of the graduate students who's been collecting the data. So, you know, I will tell you, that's not what I've heard from them. Actually, what I've heard from them and from other dendrochronologists is they did not think you could find a 500-year-old tree in central Texas. Live oaks, you know, you can't sample them. The increment borer breaks off in them. That's what the old Ironsides was made out of, live oak. That's why, the British couldn't sink it. But, so at any rate, there was a feeling among some of the folks when we got the study started, you would not be able to find trees really that were over 300 years old, and we are finding them. Two, some of the previous research, which you're talking about, you know, that relies heavily on tree rings from the Texas-Louisiana border, from the Guadalupe Mountains, from New Mexico, California, and the Republic of Mexico. And so Texas has really been a blank spot in the map for the most part with regard to tree ring studies. Now, one of the study that we're doing is being led by Dr. Malcolm Cleveland, who is you know, a compatriot of Dr. Staley there at the University of Arkansas Tree Ring Lab, and he had collected some cores from post oak trees in the Gonzales area. I think maybe about 10 years ago, and found some trees which were up to 300 years old. But there really isn't much in central Texas, or hasn't been much in central Texas. And so this is going to definitely add to our knowledge of climate in this region. And so unlike previous studies, we're not going to have to rely as heavily on chronologies that were collected, you know, some thousands of miles away.
If I may, I was going to add something on the comment you ended with, which is Raymond Slade talking about it's not the drought of record, it's the drought of record per capita, which I think is an excellent point because the population of Texas in the 1950s was, I don't know what it was, but it was a lot less than it is now. And it doesn't take these days as much of a drought for a river system to feel the pain. And so, for example, you know, things were looking pretty grim for the Highland Lake systems. And that was after a drought that was maybe a year, year and a half, 2 years. You know, what if that had gone on for another 5 years? And that puts that drought of record into perspective.
My question is for Dr. Mace. I'm curious to hear a comment, perhaps, on why the Texas Water Development Board decided to overrule the recommendations of the GMA 9 to hold the water level at where it is instead of adding 9 more feet of drawdown to it. Why that decision? Just a comment on that.
You want me to talk about that, or it's not apropos to the topic, so
yes,
I'm looking
yes,
to the...
Yes, it's not associated with climate change.
I'm happy to talk with you...
One-on-one afterwards.
I'm happy to talk with you afterwards.
Yeah.
We've been talking an awful lot about water, and it seems as if we're just talking about trying to deal with a symptom and not the root cause. You know, ever since we started burning... Carbon had been sequestered for millions of years to increase the carbon dioxide level in the atmosphere, causing global warming. If this really is the cause of what problems we're having now, why don't we try to address that issue in hopes of trying to deal with the water problem?
Could you repeat that question? I don't think I caught all of it. It was a little bit fuzzy.
My question is, if global warming is due to the increase in carbon dioxide in the air, which is probably being caused by burning coal and oil that's been sequestered for millions of years, raising the level of carbon dioxide, causing global warming, and that, in fact, is causing our problems with water, why aren't we looking at the root cause instead of the symptom of what we're talking about tonight, which is the water shortages?
I'm afraid I caught global warming and carbon dioxide there. I think if someone closer could just kind of summarize the question or even type it in. I hate to answer what I thought you were asking unless I know for sure.
Can you hear me, Catherine?
Yes, I can hear you.
What I understand the question to be is that we're having a lot of discussion about what we can do with respect to water resources in response to human-forced climate change. Why aren't we dealing with the source of the problem, which is increasing CO2? And Todd and I thought you would be a good one to answer that question.
Yes. Well, that is exactly what I was trying to touch on at the very end of my talk, the fact that we need to try to reduce the impact that we're having on our planet. And we have to do that because the greater the mitigation that we can achieve, the less adaptation is going to be required. And the better the chance we have of successfully adapting to change. If change happens that is so rapid and so large that we can't adapt to it, then we have a serious problem. Whereas if we can manage to reduce the impact we're having so that our change happens more slowly and to a lesser degree, then we have a much greater chance of successfully adapting to our changing conditions. So the best way to do that is, like I said, most of our problem, not all of it, but most of it, is because we're depending on these old ways of getting energy, the same ways of getting energy that we've been using for hundreds of years. And the time has really come to say, what are some other ways that we can get our energy, ways that we can get energy right here from our wind, from the sun, from the tides, ways of energy that are not going to run out on us, that don't require water to generate them, and again, that are homegrown and that won't contribute to the problem. So I completely agree. And that's the direction we need to be moving in, not as a penalty, but rather as an opportunity for the future.
And I was just going to add to that, that, you know, as a state water agency, we don't have the ability to tell the world to ramp down the CO2 emissions. And so as water planners, we can look at the range of possibilities. And you know, if you go look at the climate models, they'll often have different scenarios, an assumption of no action, no global action being taken on reducing CO2 levels, maybe a certain level of action being taken. And so as water planners, we're just looking at the range of what ifs and what might be in the future. But we don't have the authority to do that.
Robert, one question. You mentioned early on resilience as a portion of the water solution. What's the Water Development Board doing to encourage or support reductions in evaporation or reduction in evapotranspiration?
As part of the regional water planning process, some of the planning groups look at brush control as a way of increasing both runoff as well as recharge to aquifers. Some other state agencies are actively doing work, say around San Angelo, doing studies on that. There's some federal studies. I know Brad Wilcox with Texas A&M has done some work out in the Hill Country. As far as decreasing evaporation, I don't know what we're doing. I don't think we're doing anything to decrease evaporation.
I have more of a concern than a question, and in regards to your comment about adaptation to the changing climate. Along with the changing climate, in my lifetime, I've seen a changing population. I've seen a population that is not adapting. I see a population that expects a particular type of comfort and expects water. And yet I see this change occurring in our resources. And so I'm concerned that if we don't start adapting now, if we wait for our industry to change, for our boards to do things differently, some way we don't change our population and help them adapt or make them aware they need to start adapting now, it's going to be fairly critical when the adaptation does come. I don't think we can handle it. Could you have comments on that, please?
Well, drought is a great way of getting people's attention, I guess you might say. If you look at the major water legislation that the state of Texas or the legislature's passed in the state of Texas, it generally follows significant droughts. We are reactive or not proactive with regard to, determining how much water we have and can we get along with what we have, or do we have to change the way that we live our lives. Now, the water planning process, which Robert has already talked about, is an attempt to get us to think about those things, whether we've got a drought going on or not. We'll say that you see cities such as City of San Antonio, which has become much more efficient in its use of water over the last two decades as a result of really the Endangered Species Act litigation, which created the Edwards Aquifer Authority and led to a number of changes. But we're really not very good about, acting proactively about some of these things, changing our behavior. But people seem to be changing. And one of the reasons why they may have been changing more recently, even in the absence of drought, is that the price of water is going up. And, people will react to price signals. And, as water becomes more and more expensive, it's more and more expensive to have a St. Augustine lawn that's green all summer long. And so that helps to change people's behavior as well. But there's no question that behavioral changes, you know, really kind of lag. And it seems like we often have to go through, you know, really gut-wrenching drought or something like that to make, you know, really big strides.
Dr. Mays, I think I understood you to say that your area of expertise is water science and conservation. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Just as we hear all of the time about the fact that one of the things we can do to reduce the usage of energy more than anything else, really, is conservation. And I think the same thing is true of water. And I wonder what your agency is doing to provide incentives or policies to encourage water conservation, and I'm specifically referring to rainwater harvesting, which we have been doing for 13 years. That means 13 years we haven't pulled anything out of anybody's river or aquifer.
Mm-hmm. Well, first I'll applaud you on that. I have a 800-gallon tank in my backyard in Austin, but it doesn't meet all my needs. We do a lot at the Water Development Board with respect to conservation. We have a conservation division, and they are currently they do a lot of things. You know, they work with communities in doing water loss audits to see how much water there is being lost to their distribution systems. You know, we see some communities that the treated water or the pumped water they stick into their distribution system, they might lose 40% of it from leaks and pipes and things like that. So we work with them both in trying to identify those leaks and then helping them fix those leaks. Our agency, we do science, we do planning, and then we're also a bank, essentially. We give loans and grants. And so we'll give loans and grants to deal with some of those issues. And it's also an opportunity to work with communities to get them to use their water more efficiently. And so there's a requirement that they do a water loss audit. It's a requirement to get a loan from us that they submit a water conservation plan. What are they going to do to conserve more water in the future? The regional water planning process, I think, has helped a lot as well in conservation. When the first state water plan came out, there was some conservation. It increased greatly with the subsequent plan, where looking out 50 years into the future, some 20% of the future sources of water are going to come from conservation. And I suspect that's probably going to increase with time. Two legislative sessions ago, the legislature created a Water Conservation Advisory Council. It's a collection of folks from industry, agriculture, municipalities, state agencies, other parties. They get together and talk about how the state's doing with conservation, how we can promote conservation better across the state.
This question is for Catherine. The question has to do with tipping points with regard to climate change. And this is another complex cycle. You know, we know that CO2 elevated CO2 levels are causing, the warming, the greenhouse effect. But carbon is also very complex in the environment. There's a lot of carbon locked up in bicarbonates in the ocean. There's a lot of carbon in the peat underneath the permafrost in the Arctic. There's a lot of carbon sitting around. What does climate change have to say about this concept of a tipping point where these negative versus positive feedback loops start kicking in and we start getting other sources of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere in addition to those caused by fossil fuels?
Mm-hmm. Well, you've put your finger on one of the main concerns that we have in climate change science. If you look at the ice ages, for example, about a third of the temperature change between the ice age and the warm period that followed, like now, about a third of that temperature change was because we got more energy from the sun, just because of a simple change in the Earth's orbit that happens every 100,000 years. But two-thirds of the warming between the last ice age and now was because of releases of natural amounts of carbon dioxide after the temperatures warmed a little bit. So that makes us really concerned about what might happen today, because we are warming those temperatures. And in the past, warming temperatures have triggered massive releases of carbon dioxide from the melting permafrost, from the ocean. And if that happened, that would enhance the human component of the warming. It could enhance it by up to a factor of 3. And so the idea of a tipping point is one that says, you know, if we push the system too far, it might react very strongly in an unexpected and very unpleasant and undesirable ways. And so the basic response to that is, the less change that we cause, the less the risk that something like that is going to happen. The further we push our system, the further we push our Earth away from what it's supposed to be at right now, the greater the risk that something's going to happen like that.
So related to your answer, all the climate models are based on a sort of a gradual, you know, increase and a gradual change. None of these models predict anything, any precipitous change in climate.
The models that we're using are looking at what we expect to happen over the next couple of, you know, the next decades to century, and they do just look at gradual change. Some models have been used to try to look at abrupt changes, like what would happen if the ocean circulation could actually shut down because we're getting too much fresh water coming into the ocean. And we've also looked at past records, and you can see that actually in the past, some of these things have happened before. They're not fantasy. They're real things that have happened. And if they happen again, they would cause major, major disruptions to our infrastructure, the way that we live. Our agriculture, our cities, everything that we do is built upon assumptions regarding what's the usual conditions that we can expect if you live in Chicago, if you live in Texas, if you live in India. And if those conditions change radically, there's the potential for enormous amounts of suffering.
One more question.
Dr. Hayhoe, I just want to ask you if you're hopeful that we can make these changes before it's too late.
I have to be hopeful. but there are a couple of important things that we need to know, I think, that will encourage us. And that is the fact that, first of all, if you look at who all is contributing to this problem, and therefore who controls the solution to this problem. In the U.S., we as individual people, as individuals, we are responsible for about a third of the heat-trapping gases. And what that means is that by making some sensible and some reasonable choices about anything as simple from our light bulb to the next appliance that we buy or the next car that we drive, we actually have the potential to make enormous change. If every household in the U.S. replaced just one light bulb with a compact fluorescent, first of all, each of us would save $30 over the lifetime of the bulb because it uses less electricity. But second of all, that would be equivalent to taking 1 million cars off the road. If every household in the U.S. replaced its most commonly used light bulbs with compact fluorescents, that would be enough to stop the increase in heat-trapping gas emissions from the U.S., that step alone. Every time I drive south of Lubbock, it seems like I see hundreds of more wind turbines sprouting up like mushrooms all over the plains. These wind turbines are giving us electricity that has no carbon dioxide associated with it. It doesn't use any water. It doesn't produce any heat-trapping gases. This is the way of the future. And so every time I drive out of Lubbock, that gives me hope that we can change.
I'd like to thank our panelists. A round of applause, please.